Morning and welcome to what we hope is a stimulating and very importantly interactive session. And you might wonder, how does one get interactive in a room so large? I'm wondering that myself. But we have here today a panel of friends and colleagues who have tremendous insights and experiences to share, and we want to be sure we have some interaction with the entire audience. During the course of the session, there will be cards being distributed by the ushers and volunteers as a way for you to be able to ask questions, which will then facilitate and hopefully get panelists to answer. My name is Mitchell Warren. I direct the AIDS Vaccine Advocacy Coalition, and it is a tremendous honor to chair this session with a group of individuals that I have had the privilege to work with them individually and in their institutions over the last several years. And one of the most important lessons I think any of us have learned in HIV and HIV prevention research over the last several years, but particularly the last year of HIV prevention research, is something that a colleague, Connie Kellum, said about a trial result when she presented recently. And she was explaining the research, and at the end she said the most important lesson she learned was to work with people you trust, you respect, and you enjoy. So for me to chair this session is a great privilege, because the people you have in front of you are people that I trust, respect, and enjoy working with. And that makes the challenges of science, the challenges of research and development, that much easier. The format for today is quite simple. Each of the individuals will present, and we will not take questions in between. And then we're going to facilitate a discussion, again, with the panel and hopefully with your questions as well. So let me begin by introducing Dr. Tachi Yamada, who currently is the president of Global Health at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, an organization that some of you may have heard of. He has been in that position for the past 2 years. Prior to that, Dr. Yamada had a distinguished career in the private sector, most recently overseeing the research and development program for GlaxoSmithKline. He is going to provide an overview of the fields of vaccines and microbicides, and provide an umbrella, really, for the subsequent presenters to provide some detailed perspectives. So I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Yamada, who I think has no slides, correct? Excellent.
Thank you very much, Mitchell. And thank you to the group that will be following me. I'm really honored to be amongst them today. Let's look back for a minute and think about what has happened in the 2 years since Toronto. A lot has happened. Perhaps the most positive thing that we can point to is the fact that two million additional, or nearly 2 million additional patients living with HIV have been put on therapy. A very positive thing. But we also have to reflect on the fact that in these 2 years, another 5 million people have actually contracted the illness. So we still have a long way to go. And as good a job as we have begun to do in treatment, we still have a very important challenge in prevention. On the prevention side, we've also had some advances and some setbacks. One of the most important advances is the discovery that indeed circumcision does prevent the transmission of HIV. But we've also had some less positive results with our microbicide trials and with our HIV vaccine trials. But let's reflect for a minute on what these results tell us. Because in a real sense, clinical research, or research in general, is not a matter of success or failure. It's a matter of what we learn on the road to success. Success, as you know, is often littered with failure. So I want to reflect a little bit on what we have learned from the research that has been undertaken over the past 2 years in HIV prevention. First, let me reflect on the fact that my previous position before joining the Gates Foundation was to be in charge of a large pharmaceutical company research and development organization. And what we learned in that organization all too well is the fact that making new medicines or vaccines is one of the most difficult human endeavors. 9 out of 10 candidate drugs or vaccines that go into studies in humans that have passed the test of safety, formulation, manufacture, and gone into human trials, 9 out of 10 of them fail. Only 1 in 10 succeeds. But these failures inform future successes. So the industry continues to invest despite the fact that at the beginning we are all too often faced with setbacks. What we have learned from this in our field, I think, is first and foremost to accept that a failure is not a forever failure. A failure is a momentary setback on the road to success. And more importantly, I think we have a broad public to educate about this, because whenever the news of a trial failing goes out, the immediate assumption is that that was a bad investment. Nothing could be further from the truth. We have to engage the public to understand that the road to success begins with setbacks. Now, we've also learned some technical things about clinical trials, and there are two interesting aspects of our clinical trials that have really made it difficult for us to get positive results. In the first place, in the control groups, the patients that are not treated but serve as the control group for the trials, we have to apply the best tools available for counseling for preventing the transmission. So the net effect is that the control group has a lower rate of infection than we had assumed when we planned the clinical trials. And then on the test group, on the group that we're testing to see the efficacy, the group that gets the intervention, what we have found is that they're not always compliant with what they are supposed to do or take. And therefore, the effect of the intervention is lower in the clinical trials. So these two facts we have learned the hard way, that it is very much a difficult challenge for us to do these trials and get positive results. The other very important aspect of our clinical trials is that we've learned that preparation is critical. The preparation goes beyond the science or the idea. The preparation goes into the mundane aspects of pharmacokinetics or formulation or simple matters of clinical trial design or the appropriate kinds of toxicity studies. Because if we don't do those the right way at the beginning, we pay the price downstream after having spent a lot of money. We've learned that sometimes the animal models that we work with don't predict what will happen in humans. This is natural. It does mean that we have to think very carefully about what animal models we will use to predict the results of our trials. Now, in terms of prediction, I think the most important lesson that we have learned is that vaccine science is still more of an art than a science. We have very little predictive knowledge about when a vaccine will work and when it won't. So much of our vaccine portfolio that we work with today is based on empirical trials rather than on predictive, scientifically based trials. So we have to learn much, much more about the fundamental basis of immunity. We have to learn more about what are the predictive correlates of immunity. One of the great advantages of the STEP trial, the trial that was undertaken by Merck, the vaccine trial that failed for HIV, was that, as you will hear from Susan Bookbinder, we have learned so much that will help us, hopefully, to predict next time what to look for in our candidate vaccines before they go into large-scale trials as to whether they will work or not. The reason why this is so critical is because every new idea can't be tested in a large-scale clinical trial. There's not enough money in the world to do that. So we have to be much smarter about finding what are the correlates, whether it's animal models or human biomarkers that will predict a positive immune, protective immune response. And that is a major challenge for the science of vaccinology. So the question is, where do we go from here? I think we still clearly need a lot of new ideas. We need innovation. And towards this end, we in the Gates Foundation have started this program called Grand Challenges Explorations. This was the idea of venture capital for new ideas, and those new ideas would come from everywhere in the world. And we had a process of review so that it wasn't peer review in the classical sense. It was review by scientists who were not co-opted by too much prior knowledge in the field that would prevent them from accepting new ideas. And we've had a wonderful, wonderful turnout of applicants. Our first proposals, our first request for proposals produced 3,800 proposals, of which 2,800 were evaluable. We had each of these proposals reviewed by 6 different people, and it looks like we're going to fund 100 new ideas this round, and we anticipate over the next 5 years we will fund up to 1,000 of these new ideas. We provide $100,000 up front for the idea, and then if the idea really works out, we're prepared to provide $1 million over the next 2 years, and if that works out, we're really prepared to fund even higher levels for the truly novel ideas. In HIV, we got some very interesting proposals, really some fabulous ideas, but the most important aspects of these ideas is that they turn the world upside down. For example, maybe focusing on host antigens rather than on virus antigens for developing vaccines. Maybe reducing the immune response rather than enhancing the immune response. Maybe promoting more mutations rather than fewer mutations. All these are really challenges to dogma, which can hopefully lead to really new ideas for HIV vaccines. We also feel that there has to be more collaboration, more cooperation, more alignment in how we work together, because there are very limited resources, as much as we and the NIH and the Wellcome Trust and others have for this area of research. If we don't collaborate, then the possibility is that we will be guilty of wasting our efforts and our resources on redundant efforts. So the HIV vaccine enterprise is a critical element, and Alan Bernstein will talk more about that in a minute. And the third aspect is we need big investments for the future. This is not a time to step away and say we need to spend less on this stuff. What it is a time, now that we have some learnings, we really need to move forward with big investments in the future to invest not only in the basic science of HIV prevention, but also in the clinical trials for HIV vaccine. We're only in the earliest stages of the clinical trials. The late phases cost much, much more, and we have to be there. We have to be unafraid to fail, and we have to be able to put huge resources behind our successes. So the problem is big. The course is treacherous. The challenges are huge. But I'm totally convinced that we will live in a world without HIV one day, and that will be because we have not only invested in treating the people that have the illness and are living with it, but in preventing future generations from having to live with HIV. From our perspective, this is one of the highest objectives of the foundation. And towards that end, we're prepared to put enormous resources, as much as we need to, in order to press the field forward. But it is important, and we recognize that we can't do this alone. We need partners. We need others in this room, others in countries throughout the world who are prepared to donate to this cause, other partners who are in the foundation or not-for-profit world, and most importantly, partners from the commercial for-profit world to work on this. I am certain that together we will prevent this world and future generations from having to live with HIV. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Tachi. That was a fabulous umbrella under which we're going to spend the next hour and a half. Let me next call on Dr. Alan Bernstein, who's become a neighbor in New York, but is a Canadian by origin. He is the inaugural executive director of the Global HIV Vaccine Enterprise that Tachi referred to. He has a history of starting things. Previous to the enterprise, he was the founding president of the Canadian Institute for Health Research. So it's a great pleasure to call on a new colleague in the field, Alan Bernstein.
Thank you very much, Mitchell. Tachi started his talk by focusing on what we have learned over the last 2 years since the Toronto meeting. My talk today will focus on where do we go from here. The journey towards a safe and effective vaccine against HIV is at a critical crossroads. The results of the STEP trial and the recent cancellation of the PAVE trial, I think, have served to highlight the challenges, both scientific and otherwise, that lie ahead for all of us. So today I'd like to focus on the future. Where do we go from here? Let me also echo what Dr. Yamada just told us, which is we have to be unafraid of failure. Science is not a straight line. Clinical research is not easy. Trials that vaccine candidates that don't work are par for the course. We have to be prepared for that and move on. First, let me remind you of numbers that you all know. The recent data from UNAIDS last week highlighted that we have plateaued in the number of new cases of HIV/AIDS this past year. But our goal should be not just a plateau. Our objective should be nothing less than to stop HIV. Unquestionably, the best way to stop this virus is a vaccine. The world needs an integrated plan to defeat HIV/AIDS that includes both short, medium, and long-term strategies. In the short term, we have to expand things that we know work now, currently accepted treatment modalities, for example. In the medium term, we need to explore promising approaches such as circumcision, continue our work on microbicides, and continue focusing on social interventions and education. In the long term, we need to focus on a preventative vaccine. And I show this slide to make one other, I think, key point, that the three components of an integrated strategy should not be viewed as competing with each other or mutually exclusive. That is a false dichotomy. Each of these should complement each other. We should be working together in an integrated, strategic way to defeat HIV. Just some data, old data actually, demonstrating how effective a vaccine can be. This is data from the U.S. Against various viruses, and I won't go through the numbers. They're I think quite dramatic. Basically, you can go from a million cases a year, for example, of measles, to less than 100 with a vaccine. So let's look forward. What do we need to develop a vaccine? Well, again, to echo something that Tachi just said, we need to understand the human immune response to HIV. We need to design trials that will advance our understanding of all aspects of human immunology, both the innate and adaptive immune response. We need to bring the revolution that's gone on in the last 5 years, the post-genomics revolution, to HIV vaccine development. We need to expand research on every angle we can get at, every hook that nature has provided us, and I'm included here the so-called long-term non-progressors that seem to be able to control the virus, presumably immunologically, although that remains to be proven, much better than the other 299 individuals who are infected with HIV. And I think to do that, we need to attract the best minds, particularly the next generation of vaccine researchers, and I'll say more about that towards the end. We also need to exploit non-human primate models, animal models that will inform and refine vaccine development. These models are essential for elucidating the correlates of immune protection. After 25 years, it's still not clear what effective immune protection means, for example, in those long-term non-progressors. We need to exploit these animal models to the best of our ability and to develop new ones that will allow us to go there. We need to shift our focus from simply focusing on product development and a home run mentality to research. Science, at the end of the day, is incremental. We need to advance our incremental understanding of the immune response. We need to require that all clinical research emphasize approaches that will yield new insights so that in an iterative way, the next trial will be even better. And as again, as Tachi has said, as we'll hear from Susan Bookbinder, the STEP trial, I think, has really been a paradigm of exactly what we should expect of a human trial. We need to encourage more collaboration between industry and researchers, and we need to recognize that vaccine research is no longer a mom-and-pop shop. It requires consortia, interdisciplinary consortium of researchers working together. And I'm pleased to note that many of the major funders in the world have listed some of them here, have really embarked on that consortium approach over the last few years to try to bring together researchers from all over the world to focus on specific problems involved in HIV vaccine development. We need to develop markers, molecular and cellular markers, that are far upstream of simply protection against HIV or viral load that will enable us to understand and monitor what's going on when HIV infects an individual or when a vaccine candidate is given to an individual. Viral load and clinical protection are far downstream. They take time to measure, and they're not mechanism-based, and so making it very difficult in an iterative way, as I've said, to go farther and to improve vaccine design. To do that, we need to bring this post-genomics revolution to HIV vaccine development. Those technologies, new technologies, high-throughput technologies, will allow the development of these upstream markers and direct study of immune response in humans. Systems biology, computational biology, high-throughput methodologies, multi-parameter cell sorting, RNAi technologies, et cetera, et cetera. All of these new technologies have come on board in the last 5 years. We need to bring all of that, everything we have, every part of the armamentarium to bear to focus on HIV vaccine development. To do that, I believe very strongly we need to attract the world's very best minds to the problem. Yesterday we had fantastic session, a satellite symposium, here at AIDS Mexico 2008 to discuss exactly this issue. And I think it was widely agreed at yesterday's symposium that the engines of discovery are new people. Science is all about brains, all about young people. So we need to encourage and somehow catalyze bringing the very best young minds to the field. We need to encourage investigators from countries that are most affected by HIV to bring their urgency and their fresh perspectives to the problem. And we need to encourage researchers from other fields to bring their technologies into HIV vaccine development. And we need to do that in a proactive way. Funders have a major role to play in this. Host institutions have a major role to play. And I believe all of us have a major role to play in making this happen. One reason to do that is shown in the next few slides. Makes some, I think, interesting points. If you look at when individuals received their Nobel Prize, just focus on the right there in physiology and medicine, by far the majority of them were between 35 or under 35 and 45 when they did their Nobel Prize winning research. The implication of that, of course, the flip side is that if we are capturing young people when they're now no longer young people, we're going to miss the time when their brains are the most agile and the most creative so that they can apply, for example, for the grand challenges that Tachi was talking about just a moment ago. A quote from Elias Erhuni, the director of NIH. In today's world, Marshall Nirenberg, the Nobel laureate who did outstanding work on cracking the genetic code in the 1960s, would get his Nobel Prize before he got his first R01 or individual grant from the NIH. This is an interesting demographic from Science magazine earlier this year. The red line shows the average age of an investigator receiving their first grant in 1980, or not their first grant, but all the grants, and the yellow is the 2007, and 2020 is in blue, the projection to 2020. I think you'll see that the shift is quite dramatic. There's many explanations for this dramatic shift in the demographic, but the bottom line is that the age of investigators in the United States, and I think we can extrapolate safely to other countries, is getting older. And that is not good, I think, for science. So some of the conclusions from the discussion we had yesterday are shown here. One, we need to change the perception of the field from simply product development to cutting-edge science. We need to encourage established researchers to expand their mentorship responsibilities of young scientists. We need to capitalize on the growing global health programs taking place at major universities all over the world to engage young researchers in vaccine development. We need to support the necessary bricks and mortar that one needs to do science today, particularly in developing countries. And we need to reach out to other scientific fields, as I've said. Now let me just close with a few comments about the Enterprise itself. The Enterprise was created in 2003. A paper, a landmark paper in science is shown here, in recognition, even then, 5 years ago, of the huge humanitarian and scientific challenges that were behind the development of a safe and effective HIV vaccine. The Enterprise is, as I've said here, a global partnership put together initially by the world's leading funders of HIV/AIDS research to articulate the fastest way forward to a safe and effective HIV vaccine. The Enterprise has been charged by its members to develop a global strategic plan, to serve as a global neutral convener, bringing everyone together who is committed to developing a safe and effective vaccine, and to serve as a catalyst, bringing people and sectors together to develop a vaccine. In 2005, a strategic plan was developed that highlighted six areas that should be focused on. That plan is not prescriptive, but rather serves as a very broad roadmap for all those engaged in HIV research. Perhaps as important as the strategic plan itself has been the values that are embedded in that strategic plan. Those values include strategic coordination and integration, partnerships and public engagement, accountability and transparency, and global accessibility to any vaccine that's produced at the end of the day. The global strategic plan, which is shown in this universe at the center of the universe, is a around it are the funders, researchers, industry, and community advocates that are so key that if we're going to actually develop a vaccine. I became executive director, as Mitchell Warren has just told you, in January. I've inherited, I think, astounding work that Jose Esparza and Siobhan Malone did in the Gates Foundation for 2 or 3 years, keeping the vision of the enterprise alive. At the end of the day, I don't believe that any one country, any one scientist, any one team of scientists will develop the vaccine. We need to be all pushing and pulling together to develop a safe and effective HIV vaccine. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Alan. It's a great pleasure to call up our next presenter, and I think we need to go through these a bit, who's a great friend, and is so important in that she embodies two things in what I think we all look for. Susan Bookbinder is the head of HIV research at the San Francisco Department of Health. And the two things are, one, in her research, she works on vaccines and microbicides and pre-exposure prophylaxis and behavioral interventions. And that combination approach, that combination prevention that was mentioned in the first session this morning. And the second thing about Susan, and it's been displayed in the last 9 months with the STEP result, that research is not about the result you get. It's about what you do with that result. And Susan is going to talk about the lessons learned from STEP and how we're all learning and growing and expanding. So thanks, Susan.
Thank you, Mitchell. Mitchell asked me to do three things here in the next 10 minutes, to briefly review the study design and results from the STEP study, to tell you a little bit about what we've been doing since the results came out, and then to talk about what I believe are the lessons learned from the trial. This is a schematic of the vaccine that we were testing in the STEP study. It was the vaccine that produced a cell-mediated immune response that was most robust and furthest along in testing, and it was comprised of really three components of an adenovirus replication incompetent vector that had GAG, Pol, and Neff inserts. Study volunteers were randomly assigned to receive either the vaccine or a placebo. They got three doses of one or the other in the first 6 months of the trial, and the placebo was just the diluent only, no adenovirus vector in that. We started the trial, we launched it in December of 2004, and initially enrolled 1,500 volunteers who were at high risk of acquiring HIV through sexual contact. But we limited it initially to people who had low levels of antibody against this adenovirus type 5, which is a kind of common cold virus, because we expected that their immune response would be strongest to the vaccine. When data became available from Merck's phase 1 program that this trivalent vaccine generated robust immune responses even in individuals with higher levels of pre-existing Ad5 antibodies, we enrolled another 1,500 study volunteers with higher levels of pre-existing antibody. But within each of the four strata, either the Ad5 levels were less than or equal to 18, which was the lower limit of detection of the assay, 19 to 200, 201 to 1,000 or greater than 1,000, within each of those strata, participants were randomly assigned to vaccine or placebo. And our primary hypothesis was that the vaccine might either result in a reduction in HIV acquisition rates or in a lowering of the early viral load set point. And our primary hypothesis focused on that initial cohort that had Ad5 titers of less than 200. Our secondary hypothesis was that we would have an effect on the cohort overall. Now, because this was a pivotal trial, test of concept trial that was going to help us to understand how this vaccine and how the cell-mediated immune response might provide protection, we had built in an interim analysis to look at this primary hypothesis cohort when we had an initial number of cases. And we built in a futility analysis as well. These are the sites that were represented. We had 34 sites enrolling study volunteers in North and South America, the Caribbean, and Australia. And in this first interim analysis in the low Ad5 cohort, what you see is that we saw no protection against HIV acquisition and no apparent protection in early viral load set point. And as I said, the futility analyses were designed so that if it were unlikely that with continued follow-up we would see a positive result, if that the probability of that was less than 10%, that the Independent Data and Safety Monitoring Board would tell us that and that we would have met our futility boundaries. And that's, in fact, what happened. So within 24 hours of learning these results, all vaccinations had been stopped in this trial and in a sister trial in South Africa. And within 72 hours, we began notifying study volunteers and announced the results to the public. When we went back then and looked at the entire cohort, not just the low ADD5 group, we saw two very interesting things. And the first is, if you look at the top row here, the infection rate in the vaccinated group who had ADD5 titers of less than 18, so they were ADD5 seronegative, was identical to the infection rate in the placebo arm. So the relative incidence of HIV infection in vaccinees compared to placebo recipients was 1. But when we looked at people with higher pre-existing ADD5 titers, we saw that there was an elevated risk of infection in the vaccine group compared with the placebo group, and this was quite unexpected. But if you look at the infection rates, actually, in the vaccinees and in the placebo recipients, what you see is that the infection rates across ADD5 strata remained relatively consistent in the vaccine group, but appeared lower as you went up in ADD5 titer in the placebo arm. And so that led us to ask, was this just a fluke? There was something unusual about the placebo group in the high ADD5 titer group, or given that participants were randomly assigned within each of those strata, should we have expected lower infection rates in those with higher ADD5 titers because they had different demographic and behavioral characteristics? So we went on to analyze this, and we analyzed this only in the men in the trial. While 38% of the study volunteers were women at high risk of acquisition, there had only been one infection in a woman in the trial. The vast majority of infections were in the men. And so we set out to answer three questions. The first was this a true increase in the rate of infection in the vaccinees compared to the placebo recipients after we controlled for demographic and behavioral variables at baseline? The second was this result true for all study volunteers or just subgroups? And the third was this a transient effect or was it durable? Now, when we did the multivariate analyses, we found that, in fact, after controlling for these baseline covariates, that, in fact, there was an increased risk of HIV acquisition in the vaccinees. But that when we looked for interaction, we actually saw that this did not apply to all vaccinees, but just the vaccinated men who were uncircumcised and or ADD5 seropositive. And I'm going to show you those results here, and I apologize that I'm going through this relatively quickly. There's another presentation later this afternoon that delves into this in greater detail. But if we divide the entire cohort into one of four populations, the circumcised men on the left, the uncircumcised men on the right, and then within each, those who are ADD5 seronegative and those who are ADD5 seropositive, you see that in this rightmost column, those who had both risk factors, that is, they were both uncircumcised and ADD5 seropositive, had a higher risk. The rate of infection in the vaccine group compared to the placebo group was nearly fourfold increased, and that held true across multiple multivariate models that are shown below. On the other hand, if you go to the leftmost column of data, those men who were both circumcised and ADD5 seronegative had no elevated risk of infection. In fact, the estimates were all less than one for that group. But men who had one risk factor or the other, the two middle columns, were at intermediate levels of risk. We also asked this question about, was this a durable effect or was it a transient effect? We had data on 78 weeks of follow-up through the time prior to unblinding the study volunteers. And through that time, the curve on the bottom shows the placebo recipients. The curve in red on the top shows the vaccinees. And what we saw was that within each group, infection rates appeared to be relatively stable over the first 78 weeks of follow-up. And what we wanted to do then is to follow this over time to see if those curves come together. And so what we've been doing since this time is that in collaboration with our community groups, we made the decision to unblind all study volunteers. We also explained to the study volunteers that this is a pivotal trial and that we need their continued participation in both the vaccine and the placebo recipients. And our retention rates have been very, very high, a testament to the incredible dedication of our study volunteers. We also are undergoing regulatory review now of a follow-on protocol so that we can continue to follow these study volunteers for a longer period of time and look at long-term effects and provide intensive risk reduction counseling and linkage to prevention services for all volunteers and to collect additional data and specimens that we can use to fully understand the results of the STEP study. There is still the possibility that this apparent increase in the risk of acquisition is due to confounding due to other kinds of as yet unmeasured confounders. And so we're measuring some of those, things like HSV, genital herpes status of the study volunteers, HLA typing, sexual clusters of sexual networks, and looking to see if there were efficient transmitters within clusters of sexual transmission, looking at whether risk behavior changed over time. All of those studies are underway. And we have a number of laboratory investigations trying to understand the reasons for failure, whether or not this we can see a mechanism for enhanced infection, and some intriguing leads about control of viremia in subgroups of study volunteers. We've also attempted to open up the opportunities for collaboration very broadly to get the best people to come in and help us to understand what these results mean. And we have an external advisory committee that's prioritizing the use of the laboratory specimens in this study. So these then are my top lessons from the STEP study, and I divide them into those that are scientific and those that are more community-based. I think there's no question that this has demonstrated the utility of test-of-concept trials, that we got a very quick answer. We would have had a quick answer if there were a beneficial effect, and we also got a very quick answer to this potential for harm, and that was very important for the field. It's helped us to recalibrate the non-human primate challenge models to understand more both about the challenge viruses that we use, as well as the genetic components of the animals that we're challenging, and the role that that may play in the applicability of those results to human trials. I think it's also pointed out some of the limitations in the non-human primate challenge models, and that is particularly that some of these vectors that we used, if it turns out that it mattered that these people who had been previously exposed to Ad5 had a different response to the vaccine. That's going to be challenging to study in other species where the vectors have some host range restrictions. It's also, this association with lack of circumcision was completely unanticipated and not something that we could have easily seen in a non-human primate challenge model, particularly because it's not even clear that SIV is normally transmitted across mucosal surfaces. We are getting a wealth of data with which to directly address both this, the failure of this vaccine to protect, as well as understanding more about how enhancement may have happened. It's giving us more information about the need for functional assays to measure cell-mediated immunity, and it's giving us an opportunity to find out what went wrong in the breakthrough infections. Why were those individuals not protected? And as I said, there are some intriguing leads in potential protection in some very small subgroups, things that we need to pursue again to try to understand what potential immune correlates of protection might be. So I'm going to talk about community and talk about the community both from the scientific community as well as the communities at risk perspective. I think the first lesson is that transparency is critical. Whenever you ask an important scientific question, you can't guarantee what the result is, because that's what science is about, is answering questions that you don't already have the answer to. What you can guarantee is that you'll get that information out as broadly as possible and as quickly as possible. And I think that's been a very important lesson from the STEP study. We need to prepare as best we can to communicate as broadly as we can. And you run into unexpected snags with needing regulatory approval to notify study volunteers. And I think we've learned a lot of mechanisms for communicating broadly and quickly that will benefit all prevention trials. It's clear that each prevention trial, that we are a prevention community, and that each prevention trial impacts on other prevention trials, and that we need to work on this field together. Community has been a critical part of our process at each stage in the process of both designing and developing the trial, the informed consent process, and ultimately interpreting the results. And so we, again, need those partnerships. And there's no question that study volunteers have been critical to our search for an HIV vaccine. So in conclusion, I think that the STEP study was a pivotal trial for the vaccine field. It brought us further forward than any single clinical trial has to date. We got a definitive result that this vaccine did not provide protection just 33 months after the first participant was enrolled. This has made important contributions that I think could only have been learned through clinical efficacy trials, and we're continuing to mine lessons from our trial data and specimens. And so when we talk about going back to basics, the back to basics really involves three components. It's the basic laboratory work, it's the preclinical studies in non-human primates, and it's the clinical data that will get us most quickly to an HIV vaccine. And I want to end by acknowledging our study volunteers for their ongoing dedication and commitment to our search for an HIV vaccine, and the STEP study protocol team, including my co-chairs Mike Robertson, Dan Fitzgerald, and Ann Dewar. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much, Susan. For those that work in AIDS vaccines, our next presenter and the organization he runs needs little introduction. In 1996, Seth Berkley became the president of the International AIDS Vaccine Initiative. Before I joined AVAC, I had the pleasure of working for Seth at IAVI, so it's a great chance for me to introduce my former boss and colleague and friend, Seth Berkley.
Thanks very much. Mitchell asked me to start. I'm actually going to talk mostly about IAVI, but just to remind everybody why we think a vaccine is possible. And, you know, immune control is possible. We know that the majority of HIV-infected people initially suppress the viral load. We know there are populations that are resistant. We know there are long-term non-progressors. You heard about that from Alan. There are highly exposed uninfected children of infected mothers who don't get infected. But also, we've got evidence now in animal models, both in the live attenuated SIV model and then challenging with hot viruses that you can get protection, as well as if you take human broadly neutralizing antibodies and you put them in the macaque model, you can get protection. So there's a lot of evidence that suggests that a vaccine is possible. Every 2 years, we put out an AIDS vaccine blueprint. We're going to be launching it tomorrow. And for those that are interested, there is a satellite session Wednesday evening, which is going to look 2010 forward for AIDS vaccines. In this talk, I'm not going to talk much about the blueprint, but I'll at least throw up some of the figures from it. Rather, where are we going in IAVI, and just touch on some key points. From our perspective, successful development of an AIDS vaccine is likely going to require induction of broadly neutralizing antibodies and then control of HIV, as well as live attenuated SIV controls against homologous challenge. And that's the same as well as the elite controllers control HIV in humans. No candidate in the pipeline achieves these objectives. And as you've just heard from Susan, we need better functional T-cell assays behind ELISpots, which are going to help prioritize candidates, and I'll come back to that. So to get to this success, we're going to have a breakthrough on neutralizing antibodies. We're going to have to develop more potent vectors, and I'm going to talk about that. And then finally, less focus has gone into what goes into the vectors than actually the vectors themselves, and we believe that's an important area that needs attention given the global diversity that exists. So let me just start with neutralizing antibodies. There now have been 4 neutralizing antibodies shown on the bottom that have been identified. Some of these are very broad, neutralize all strains. Over the last number of years, we've figured out the structure for them. We've figured out where they bind. And the question is, you know, we started out looking at neutralizing antibodies by having an empirical approach, as Tachi talked about. That has failed so far. We've not been able to get immunogens that are broadly neutralizing. So now the question is, can we take this apart in a systematic way? The Neutralizing Antibody Consortium uses this model, which is to go ahead and characterize and identify neutralizing antibodies. And I'm going to come back to getting new ones. Structural biology to determine the structures of them. This is a specialized robot that got built just to do this work. Then one of the hardest things to do is immunogen design. And there's a lot of people working on this now. We have a group in India that is just made of medicinal chemists focused on this problem alone. How do you screen these? We tend to use animals. There's new exciting stuff that's come out of our innovation plan, which I'll talk about, to try to create an artificial immune system. And obviously, these have to ultimately go into the clinic. So one of the questions is, if there are 4, there probably are more. We did a systematic look. We got together partners around the world to try to do a search for more neutralizing antibodies. We started off with 1,500, and this is really recent data. We've gone ahead and analyzed those, at least initially, and about 10% of the people infected for 3 years, not on drugs, show some evidence of broad neutralization, including a few super controllers that have incredibly high neutralization levels, very potent antibodies. So we're early in the stage of identifying new antibodies or families of antibodies, but we expect that we'll have new targets that are going to give us the ability to do this type of rational vaccine design. And there's a network of groups around the world that are working on this. I've listed them here. And just to say that this is a global issue, Alan really brought this up. We've got to use the best in global science around the world. Our NAC is a large group. It started out as four institutions. It's now 16 institutions spread out across the world, listed here. And our highest priority now is to take this neutralizing antibody consortium, which has been in existence for 5 years and recently was reviewed by an external panel and given very strong positive reviews, to now scale that up and get to the level of kind of systems biology in this area that will allow us to try to work with others to crack this problem. Now let me move to a different area and let's talk about really wild innovation. If you could identify these neutralizing antibodies, could you take these, since we don't know what the immunogen is to develop them, to make them occur, could you take those genes, put them in a gene delivery vector, inject them in the body, and get the levels in animals or in humans? And Phil Johnson did some really exciting work. This is in mice. He went ahead and used AAV and took a human antibody B12 and showed that you can sustain the levels of antibody in blue on the top here for, you know, a very long time, greater than 6 months, suggesting a proof of concept. There are a few broadly neutralizing antibodies for the monkey model, not that many. We need more. And then tried the experiment in the monkey model. And here's looking at some different neutralizing antibody. You can see here 3 out of 3 giving sterilizing immunity, 1 out of 3 with this antibody, 2 out of 3 with this antibody. So some exciting information. We are going to try to get the agency, the US FDA, to allow this type of experiment in people because it will allow us. This is not a strategy long term for a vaccine, but would allow us to characterize the effects of these in humans. And I think this could be an exciting area for the field. Now, I talked about live attenuated vaccines. Down here is a typical live attenuated story. You get a burst of viremia, and then you get sterilizing immunity with homologous challenge. What we know is this is the typical course of an SIV. And studies that look at a single cycle live attenuated vaccines, only replicating once, look here in the middle. So there's something about replication that's important. We don't know what it is. And so one of the issues is, to date, most of the candidates have been, for safety reasons, in the non-replicating fashion, as was the Merck candidate you just heard about. And obviously, you know, there's a lot of evidence that suggests live attenuated works, but for safety reasons, this is not going to go into humans. So one of the questions is, can we move up the efficacy pathway and move into replicating viral vectors? This hasn't been done and obviously raises enormous issues in terms of safety and regulatory issues. This is an area that IAVI is focusing on, and over on the left you can see a range of different vectors that we're moving forward, some in collaboration with the Consortium for AIDS Vaccine Development, with the Gates Foundation, a different set of groups. There are also other groups that are moving these forward, and the idea will be to try to, you know, work through constructing them, figuring out if they're stable, testing them in animals, non-human primates. And then most of these will disappear. As you heard, failure is going to be the name here, but we think this is where we have to go. To do this, for the first time, IAVI has now moved into creating its own laboratory facility in addition to the global consortiums we've done, and we will be moving later this year into a large BSL-3 facility. And this is a industrial-style, not-for-profit applied research laboratory dedicated to AIDS vaccine and development. And the main thing it'll be doing is looking at these next generation of candidates, but also preclinical immunology, integrating the neutralizing antibody consortium with our partners on T-cell vaccines, and doing process development. We're looking to link this laboratory to laboratories around the world, both for scientific collaborations, but also training opportunities to bring scientists in from the North and South to work side by side. Lastly, let me mention the issues of innovation. Tachi has already talked about the Gates Foundation Innovation Fund. We launched last September, in partnership with the Gates Foundation, a fund that had a very specific niche, and that was biotech. Could we get biotech companies that had nothing to do with HIV into this area? We got together a group of venture capitalists. Why? Because they have to convince management of biotech companies that it's worth, you know, using a little bit of their opportunity cost to work in this area. We provide seed capital for feasibility studies. It's non-dilutive, minimal diligence, a lot of speed associated with it. And again, this is not HIV. So these are companies that have no data in HIV, haven't worked on it, aren't interested. They come from cancer or therapeutic antibodies or other areas, and can we get them engaged? And we believe this does the cross-fertilization that Alan talked about, and we're trying to adopt advances that industry is moving forward and not trying to recreate the wheel. We've completed so far 4 grants. We've got 30 odd in the pipeline. And just to give you an idea of the breadth, VaxDesign is an in vitro mimic of the human immune system for rapid evaluation. That's important for high throughput screening. Spaltadec is a company that's having novel technology for human B cell screening for identifying these new neutralizing antibodies. Lipoxin is a UK company with a new delivery system for antigen presentation. And Strand is an Indian company that does in silico protein structure modeling to design immunogens. And they're looking at 4E10, which is of the 4 antibodies, one of the most potent that exists today. So, you know, in summary, this is kind of where we have to be. This is what the blueprint talks about. We have to look at the immunogens, and we have to look at platforms, and we have to have a systematic look at technical feasibility, the right animal studies, the right primate studies. You know, going into humans quickly, as you heard, it's absolutely critical. This is a human disease, not a monkey disease. Prioritizing these candidates and moving them into screening test of concept, small efficacy-like trials to get us our candidates. We are going to have more failures. The critical issue is really to continue to drive this because, as we know, you know, this is something that can happen. The issue is making sure that we focus on this goal. And lastly, I didn't talk at all about all the other things IAVI's doing, the candidates we have in the pipeline now, the work we're doing, but I do want to talk about the amazing clinical network that's out there, and it's critical to keep these network of partners going, not just ours, the HVTN, you know, the other research groups that are out there, because, again, clinical testing is absolutely critical to the discovery process, and these are amazing institutions that now have good clinical practices, good laboratory practices, and need to be supported. New generations of scientists need to be brought in as well, because it's going to be critical to test these vaccines in the places where the epidemic is most severe. So, couldn't do this without our donors. We thank all of them for the support they've given us, and thank you all for your attention.
Thanks so much, Seth. 2 quick logistics points. 1, in your program, you will see that the next presenter is Lute Van Damme. That's actually not the case. Unfortunately, Lute was unable to make it to Mexico City and is not able to present here. And the other logistics point, as I mentioned at the outset, there are volunteers with cards in the audience. If you have questions, please begin to circulate them. Put your hand up if you need to find a volunteer, and we will get cards to you so we can begin the process for that. Lest you think this session was just about vaccines, I want to remind you that it's about vaccines and microbicides. And our next presenter is Zita Rosenberg, who in the last 6 years, since 2002, has developed from a standing start the International Partnership for Microbicides into a real engine for microbicide development, setting up networks of sites, working with a number of industry partners to look at next-generation microbicide candidates, and is really taking the lead in moving into to new ideas. So it's a great pleasure to welcome Zita.
Thank you, everybody. I'm going to speak about microbicides and why we feel that there is a true cause for optimism in the field. I think many of you know, and Lute Van Damme was going to be covering a lot of this information, that it was very challenging several years for the microbicide field. And there were a number of trials of early generation microbicides that have been completed or stopped. They were comprised of surfactants, such as N9 and Savvy, or polyanions, such as cellulose sulfate, Carigard, and 2% Pro-2000. In total, 9.5 trials were completed or stopped, and the 0.5 was one of the arms of the Pro-2000 study, the 2% dose. And there are still 2 trials that are ongoing, including one study that's funded by the NIH, buffer gel and Pro-2000 at 0.5%, and another study by the by DFID, the Medical Research Council, study of Pro-2000 at 0.5%. So those are the studies that are continuing in the field. But there is a next generation of products that many of us are pursuing that are based on ARVs that are highly potent and HIV-specific. Many of these ARVs have already been established for efficacy in AIDS treatment, and many of the classes that we're using have established safety and efficacy in treatment. They comprise multiple mechanisms of action against HIV, which we feel is very important, so that these products can be developed as either single agents or in combination. And because some of these molecules are very small molecules with long half-life in the body, they can be designed for sustained protection. And if the half-life is not very long, they can also be put into intravaginal rings that would allow for 30 days or more of protection. They can come in very many different forms. The early generation were all based on gels. The newer generation can be in gels or rings, tablets, soft gel capsules, films, and many others. So one of the questions we're often asked is, why vaginal dosing? First of all, it is protection that would be specifically for women. Also, there are high drug levels where you really need them the most, which is where the virus enters the body. As well, most of the studies thus far of ARV-based microbicides are showing very low systemic exposure, which gives you a reduced chance of systemic side effects. There's a precedent in contraception for moving from oral to vaginal dosing. And theoretically, there is a lower chance of selection for resistance. But as importantly, no one prevention strategy is going to do it all. We're going to need a number of different approaches, of which microbicides should be one, and part of a combination that includes PrEP, vaccines, etc. For those of us who are short, it's really hard to see these slides. So, one of the most advanced microbicides that are in the field is topical tenofovir. Many of you know that tenofovir is, in its one of its forms, marketed as Viread, as an AIDS therapeutic. Its preclinical development as a microbicide began in the mid to late 1990s. There are proof of concept efficacy trials that are ongoing, the CAPRISA study, which will be discussed in greater detail on Thursday afternoon at the microbicide session. There's a trial that is also planned, the VOICE study for both oral and topical tenofovir. And Gilead has licensed topical tenofovir to both Conrad and IPM for development. And this slide, I don't expect you to actually read it all. It's just a listing of all of the trials that have been done in the past on topical tenofovir, the safety studies that were done both in the U.S. As well as elsewhere, and then the plans and actual studies that are going on right now for topical tenofovir. Dapivirine is another ARV-based product that is being developed as a microbicide. It is a highly potent non-nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitor. It was originally developed by Tibotec and then licensed to IPM. It was originally actually developed as an oral therapeutic and tested in about 11 safety studies. Multiple vaginal dosage forms are currently in development in gels, rings, films, tablets. A number of phase 1-2 studies have already been completed, and many more are ongoing and planned, and the phase 3 is planned for 2010. One of the formulations, the dapivirine ring, a feasibility studies of the rings have already been completed and show that there is good release of dapivirine from those rings and very good distribution in the tissue of dapivirine throughout the vaginal tract with a good safety profile and well tolerated. And the early gel formulations were also studied in many women in South Africa and in Belgium, Rwanda and Tanzania, and also showing good safety profiles. UC781 is another highly potent NNRTI. Celigy has licensed that product to Conrad. Four phase 1 studies have been completed or are currently in data analysis in Thailand and the U.S. for both vaginal and rectal exposure. Two phase 1 studies are still ongoing, one vaginal study and one male tolerance study. For the future, additional studies are planned for early 2009 as a single agent, pharmacokinetic and expanded safety, as well as a combination of UC781 with tenofovir, an early safety study. And this again is the list of the trials that have either been completed or undergoing data analysis and ongoing for UC781. PC815 is an NNRTI that was licensed to the Population Council by Medivir. It is formulated in a Carrigard base. In vitro activity suggested again, it is a potent agent, and seminal fluid does not impede its activity. HIV prevention studies are currently ongoing in the primate model, and there are plans to begin phase 1 studies next year. Now, in preclinical development is a compound called topical Maraviroc. As many of you know, Maraviroc is a CCR5 blocker. It is currently and most recently licensed as a therapeutic for the treatment of HIV infection. Pfizer has licensed Maraviroc to the IPM. Pre-formulation work is ongoing. Work towards a combination dapivirine Maraviroc formulation, either as a silicone or EVA ring, has been initiated, as well as gel work and film work will be initiated with a lot of virology ongoing. The rabbit vaginal dosing study for 28 days has also in process. PK and safety studies are planned for 2009-10, and as you know, that Selzentry is the trade name for Maraviroc currently on the market. And there is an additional pipeline of drugs that are available for development. Some of these include GP120 entry inhibitors, such as, I guess I could move this here, BMS-793. There are products, the pyrimidinediones, that are dual mechanism, both NNRTI as well as entry inhibitors. There are other NNRTIs that are also being evaluated, as well as other CCR5 blockers. And clearly, as Tachi had mentioned early on, there needs to be a robust pipeline of microbicides in order to hedge against failure of different classes of products. And so other kinds of approaches that could be looked at include integrase inhibitors and, very importantly, some small molecule fusion inhibitors. The L6644 peptide is a GP41 fusion inhibitor that is a small peptide, but the small molecule fusion inhibitors would be welcome. It's really important to add the backup drugs to the process, and especially drugs that already have a good safety profile as licensed therapeutics or are late in development as licensed therapeutics. There have been many lessons that have been learned from the early generation of trials. Some of the lessons that regarding prioritization, about the need to look across different products in the same class of action and to prioritize and move forward only the best in class into phase three. For safety, as in the vaccine field, it's very important to continue the early looks for harm in these trials, since, as Susan said, we do not know what the outcome of these trials are. That's why we are doing the studies. It's really important, especially in microbicides, that adherence be improved in these studies. Adherence could be improved by longer-acting formulations so that the gels don't need to be used at or around the time of sex. Additional product acceptability studies can help in this regard as well as the need to explore novel adherence strategies and technologies so that when we do these trials, we're ensuring as great a compliance as possible. It's also important in the trial designs that we look frequently and do early stops if the products are unlikely to show efficacy so that we can learn from that information and move on quickly to novel product design. Pregnancy has been an issue in the very early studies, but with contraceptives and counseling provided on site, those pregnancy rates have been dramatically reduced. It is clearly important from a regulatory perspective, since microbicides are a first product class, that feedback and input is obtained in advance of the trials with the regulatory bodies. And indeed, because many of the trials, not just microbicides, but also vaccines and other prevention interventions, as well as TB studies, are ongoing in similar areas, there is a problem that could occur of co-enrollment, and some of that has already happened. And so the need to have technologies in place to make sure that co-enrollment is not going on into multiple studies is important. So why are we optimistic? I think we are optimistic because there is a new generation of microbicides, and this new generation exists that are based on really highly potent ARVs. And we know that these ARVs are active against HIV in the body. And that these ARVs also represent multiple mechanisms of action that can be developed as both single agents and in combination. And that they also provide a longer duration of protection, so that 30-day rings or once-daily use gels can enable women to adapt them into the context of their lives more easily and allow the clinical trials to be conducted with hopefully greater adherence. And these multiple formulations also give women more options because there will not be one kind of product that will be appropriate for all women. And I think the increased focus that many of us now have on adherence and that the conduct of the trials needs to be done with, one could argue, daily contact with the participants to ensure adherence to product, are those kinds of designs are in process. And the adaptive designs to look at multiple products at the same time, drop the arms that are not as successful as the others, and move forward with your best in class are in development. And I think that the microbicide field in general has received over time increasing support from donors, from the pharmaceutical companies, from the scientific community, and from advocacy and local communities, so that these products are moving forward with great speed. And as importantly, as one of Africa's most distinguished leaders for health and human rights, especially for women, has said, a microbicide could mean the difference between life and death for millions of women. Let us do everything in our power to accelerate its development. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you so much, Zita. And that last slide I'll leave up as I introduced our next presenter. In addition to this panel being about vaccines and microbicides, it's as important to understand that research and development is both about science and about the communities where science takes place and with whom science works. Our next presenter is Manju Tatani, who is the coordinator of the African Microbicide Advocacy Group, an organization she co-founded 5 years ago. She has been a distinguished leader not only in microbicide advocacy, but in finding opportunities to give voice to often voiceless communities in fighting for not just microbicide development, but for prevention and prevention research.
Thank you very much to the conference organizers for taking this issue seriously and inviting me to talk about advocacy around microbicides in the South. So let me take just the one question. Why should we still be advocating for new prevention options, especially with the trials and tribulations in the last few years? It's true. It's difficult times. Now we have to be more clear on the why, on the what, and the who of HIV prevention research advocacy. But the truth is, the facts have not changed. African women, in fact, women world over, are still disproportionately infected by HIV. They still have to ask permission to protect themselves from HIV. In fact, for all people, we need to scale up existing HIV prevention options, and we desperately need new options to expand the range of options available. An effective microbicide would be an exciting addition to that range. And more so, women are demanding an option that they can control and initiate themselves. We've heard a lot today about the scientific challenges. But HIV prevention research is not only about science. It's about broader issues of involvement and engagement with community and civil society groups. Success of research now and of future access depends on this broader engagement now. So I want to tell you a little bit about where I come from. I represent the African Microbicides Advocacy Group, an African regional network launched in 2004. That leads a coordinated African engagement in setting and moving forward the microbicides advocacy and research agenda. We connect about 500 advocates and researchers from 30 countries across Africa and beyond. And the truth is, with the majority of clinical trials in Africa, with hundreds of African researchers and advocates, and thousands of African trial participants, it's time to amplify realities and needs on the ground. As you can guess, my presentation will be primarily about experiences from Africa. Advocacy around HIV prevention research happens at several levels and by a variety of partners. At the center of it all is research and the trial participant. At the international level, in microbicides advocacy, you have groups such as the Global Campaign for Microbicides, the International Rectal Microbicides Advocacy Group, and AVAC, actually. But I'll be talking primarily about advocacy that happens at the regional, national, and the larger community level. Regional groups we have in Africa include AMAG and the Southern African AIDS Trust. We'd like to see groups like SWA and AFRICASO, of course, take up some leadership too. And national groups that are in leadership right now include the Nigerian HIV Vaccine and Microbicides Advocacy Group, the Gender AIDS Forum in South Africa, the Treatment Action Campaign, and the Gambia Microbicides Advocacy Group. It's a short list. We really need to do a lot more in building skills and our cadre of advocates in Africa. There are really not that many full-time new prevention technology advocates. I can probably count them on my hands and feet. Advocates for vaccines and microbicides are usually people that come from NGOs, from CBOs, they're clinicians, they're people living with HIV, treatment activists, trial participants, researchers, counselors, policymakers, gender activists. There are very few people who spend morning, noon, and night looking at this issue. And to date, the advocacy trends we've seen in countries have ranged from countries such as Mali, with just a few engaged individuals, to countries like South Africa and Nigeria, where there's more specific activities and strategic planning towards policy change. Primarily, you're going to see across Africa, and I would venture Asia as well, that in most countries you see a few individuals, passionate individuals, spearheading activities. In other countries, such as Senegal and Cameroon, you have different groups that occasionally will do some advocacy work, but it's not very linked. You have countries like South Africa and Gambia that are looking at ways to collaborate and beginning to think more strategically about advocacy around prevention research. Countries like Kenya and Uganda, you have more strategic partnerships and you see an infrastructure developing. In a country like Nigeria, you have a much more robust coalition, and you see that they have activities and strategic planning. But we are yet to see broad-based coalitions where the issues around HIV prevention research advocacy are integrated into the larger HIV picture. And also, it's interesting to note that the kinds of advocacy campaign really depends on who are the leaders of it at that moment. So, for example, if you take NAVMAG in Nigeria, it was started by a clinician and a journalist. And they focus right now, the group focuses on advocacy on ethics and research issues. If you look at Uganda, where SWA Uganda was critical in the startup, the real focus is on policy and women's health. In South Africa, with the Gender AIDS Forum and Treatment Action Campaign, you're going to see a lot of the advocacy around gender analysis and a rights-based approach. In Zimbabwe, ICW had an important role initially, and so you're going to see HIV-positive women's issues quite high. So what do advocacy groups in the South advocate for, and what do they do? Very often, they are looking to engage in the research process more, to try and change how research as usual happens, for more ethical research and a research agenda that is responsive to needs on the ground, for inclusion and partnership of civil society in the research process, for greater community involvement in trials from conception to planning for eventual access, for more social and behavioral science, for access to treatment during and after the trial, for more research in rectal microbicides, for research responding to the concerns of HIV-positive women, and to start discussing future access issues now. Oh, dear. Also work on fostering leadership and ownership by the most affected and where trials happen in the South, to try and create an enabling environment in our own countries by supporting local research development, increased funding, and capacity building for local researchers. For taking leadership and ownership of the research process by trying to get our governments to look at developing national plans and guidelines about how research should be conducted in our country. And trying to get other AIDS regional groups on board to take these issues on their own agenda. Also, we look to build a capacity to engage better in the research process by advocating for research literacy for communities, for sharing accurate information around groups, or across groups, facilitating South-to-South sharing of learning, information, experiences, and as a platform for dialogue and critique, and building capacity so that advocates and community groups are more informed players and can more aptly engage in the research process. In fact, there are different kinds of advocacy, and advocates usually naturally select themselves into what they focus on, and there are really three categories we've seen of the kinds of advocates we have. Those who are advocating for the need for new options, who keep the ground-based demand visible, those who really want to engage with the research process and for more ethical prevention research, and those who, and this is probably the majority, who are really interested in eventual access and what we will do when we have effective products. And, you know, advocacy comes in tons of shapes and forms. Some of the advocacy successes we can claim thus far as a collective and in partnership with groups in the North include increased resources for the field, improved standard of care in trials, including contraception at microbicide sites and sexual health care for participants, ongoing access to care for HIV-positive people who screen out of trials and those who seroconvert during trials. For community input and protocols, and for example, the Microbicides Trial Network is right now looking for community input right when they develop their protocols. For improved informed consent processes, for a place at the table for advocates, something we hadn't had before, for better relationships between researchers and advocates, for partnership initiatives and guidelines such as the Good Participatory Practice Guidelines and the Microbicide Media and Communication Initiative, working around media trial sites, of championing emerging issues such as care of trial site counselors, communication challenges, and local researcher voices, and really trying to raise trial participant voices. And finally, learning lessons in managing trial results. And I want to spend just a minute talking a little bit more about that. We had 7 years to learn. In 2000, we responded to the Nanoxonal-9 results, a trial whose results showed that some of the women using the product had an increased vulnerability to HIV. In 2007, we responded to the cellulose sulfate results, a trial that was closed early because of a trend in the preliminary data showing the same thing. Similar message in the results, different reactions and responses. With Nanoxonal-9, there was confusion, miscommunication, even anger and a backlash that we're still experiencing now. But with cellulose sulfate, it was a bit different because the context had changed. It was a new era. There was more informed and engaged advocates. The trial was closed early because of safety concerns. There was communication with advocates during and after the trial. Like the past, there were media inaccuracies, you know, fueling an already volatile situation, but not to the same degree because there was not this, advocates didn't urge it on. Because key advocacy groups were owning part of the process, for example, AMAG and the Treatment Action Campaign sent press releases in support of continued research. And because the trial closures came at a time when the field was actively involved in building better relationships at trial sites, between research teams, between advocates and groups, and this bridge building has helped to foster a new trust, a new respect, and a new understanding of the various perspectives we bring. Importantly, and slowly, what's developing is a shared ownership of the field. The important lessons that I often echo from the experience is that it's important to ensure coordination, collaboration, and communication with partners throughout the process, and not only when responding to a crisis. That advocates are communicators on the ground, to the larger community, to the field, to the government, and that the strength of advocates are as partners and allies, not to be controlled or managed. We have many challenges in building leadership in the South, and number one on our list, as you can imagine, is resources, resources, resources. Also, the field is changing and rapidly growing with increasingly complex and evolving information. There are more international players in Africa, and coordination between groups and honest appraisal of these partnerships becomes important. The most difficult thing really is, as Martin Luther King said, keeping the faithful faithful, keeping advocates active, engaged, and their hopes alive during the long haul. To manage some of the confusion around the recent trial closures and results, to help release some of the pressure on overburdened groups on the grounds, called on by international groups and regional groups to come to every meeting to coordinate everybody's priority on the ground, to manage expectations around microbicides, tell the truth, don't oversell an unproven product, yet keep hope alive. Raising voices of trial participants. We have 15, 16, 30,000, yet they're the most invisible people in this whole thing. Integrating prevention research advocacy into the larger agenda and broadening our scope. So, just an example of how we have to manage expectations, balance between over-promising the oasis and under-promising prevention research as a long haul. So how do we respond to these challenges? There are some innovative funding mechanisms that we're looking at. One of them, for example, is a new funding window, a small grant-making initiative for advocacy groups that several groups are working to try and create with the leadership from the global campaign. To communicate, in the past, miscommunication and a lack of transparency has fueled underlying trust issues. to change our messages, focus on the whole research process rather just on trial and trial, and to expect some disappointments. To move our approach from cheerleading to really managing expectations, to proliferate accurate information, because in the absence of accurate information, it can be filled with anything. To move from more proactive to reactive advocacy, to think ahead so that government officials are regularly updated, and to continue to build trust between groups. So, as the title of this session asked, where do we go from here? As warriors for HIV prevention. I love this image. It's called The Wounded Amazon by Franz von Stuck, because she's a wounded but not broken warrior, and her shield looks like a great big cervical barrier. So, like her, we must reinvigorate the need for prevention. We must reassess the field and look at the best way forward. And, borrowing words from Deborah Waxley from the forum yesterday, know that discouragement is not an option. Women and men are still dying. The fight is not over. We still need more and better prevention options and programs. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Manju. That was fabulous. We have one final presentation. I can tell you already the questions are outstanding. Please keep them coming. We will find ways, and I'll describe them later, how we're going to respond to all of them. Our next and final presenter is Pedro Guaycochea from Peru. Pedro is a fabulous person to be rounding up this session. He's a communicator by training, a researcher. He helped co-found Impacta in Peru, an organization that is become a major clinical trial site for vaccine research, for pre-exposure prophylaxis research, keeping in mind all the time that it's about how that site and how that community organization is engaged throughout the research process. So, Pedro.
Thanks, Mitchell. I want to thank the organizers who invited me to share some of the experiences we have had in moving things in HIV prevention forward in Peru and Ecuador. I just want to start by... Where is my presentation?
I failed.
Oh, sorry. This
and
one.
Then we click up there. So sorry.
Oh,
so,
no. Okay. So I just want to start by sharing with you a very inspiring quote from one of the screenees in the chemoprophylaxis for HIV prevention in men study being implemented in Peru, Ecuador, and the U.S. This is a final optional comment to a behavioral interview applied by computer-assisted self-applied interview at the screening visit of the study. So we do not know if this participant enroll or not. The services I got in this clinic have been very good. The environment is very pleasant, warm, and you feel at home. Thus, it made me feel very good. Well, I want to thank you for this at IPREX. I will put all of my effort to collaborate and make something very big for the history of humankind. That is to find an alternative to prevent HIV. Well, not much else to say. Thanks for your attention to this. The quote speaks for itself. What HIV prevention research participants want is to do something about it. Do something about it very comfortable. They want to feel at home. This faces us and the scientists with great responsibilities. We need to keep on looking forward to an alternative to HIV prevention. So I want to continue with a little background of the clinical trials unit in Peru. Peru has a concentrated epidemic in gay men, other MSM, and the trans population, with prevalence figures between 14% and 28%, depending on the city and the time of the measurement, with an incidence between 3.1 and 6.1, also depending on the observational study. Impacta in Lima, Peru, started back in the year 2000 as an HIV-AIDS research organization with a very large community involvement program to raise awareness about HIV/AIDS and HIV prevention research. These activities initiated by the creation of a community advisory board, the organization of community forums, and the organization and planning of community engagement activities. We, as a CTU, expanding our operations to other cities in the south, especially in the jungle of Peru, where the prevalence tended to be higher than in Lima. And we started operations in Iquitos in 2001, in Pucallpa in 2002, and then in Guayaquil in Ecuador in 2006 with a community-based organization that got into HIV prevention research. And then later on in Lima with another organization called Investigaciones Médicas en Salud. So this table give an idea of the activities that the clinical trials unit have developed in these different cities. The CTU, the clinical trials unit, has enrolled nearly 9,100 people in different HIV research studies and trained nearly 2,300 people in HIV-related activities. If we estimate that the ratio of screening to enrollment is 3-1, so we could tell that we have a screen for any of our clinical trials around 10,000 people. And among all the studies that we have implemented, we have several that were very challenging. The first challenging study was the SMART study. This study assessed continue versus episodic antiretroviral treatment. The study was stopped because it showed that interruption ART was an inferior strategy to continue the ART. We followed and continue to see the participants, but it was our first challenge, how to communicate a trial participant that the study does not work and does not have the outcomes that we expected as researchers. We had another large prospective in clinical intervention that was the herpes suppression for the prevention of HIV infection in HSV2 positive individuals, where we in Peru enrolled 1,500 volunteers, all male, men who have sex with men at high risk of HIV. Unfortunately, this study also proved not to be efficacious for the prevention of HIV. So we were faced again with the challenge of communicating 1,500 people that trusted us that the study didn't have the outcome we expected. Later on, the Merck HIV study that Susan talked about before enrolled 500 participants and volunteers in Peru. And the study, as you already know, was stopped by the DSMB in September of 2007. This was another challenging situation to communicate the participants that the expected results didn't were what we wanted. So what does it mean to us to really sit in front of a participant as a counselor to tell them that we might probably know by the end of the study will not work? That it's very challenging in terms of we want people to enroll in the studies because we really need alternative to HIV prevention. But at the same time, we need to tell them that these interventions might not work and that probably by the end of the study, there will be no answer for them. Regardless of these challenging situations, we started enrolling participants in the chemoprophylaxis for HIV prevention in men that started in July 2007. And we have enrolled 1,010 participants so far up to last week. And we have still 92% retention in the study. That means that there is something there that we might have done well. And what I could say from our lessons learned. Involve the communities and work with them. Include them in the decision-making process and assess what is it that they want. We need the communities to really build up and construct and design the kind of studies and interventions that are good for them. So we need from them just to get a good study design. To not patronize the communities, sometimes researchers and scientists think that they know what is good to the community. The community know what they want for them, and they want a safe alternative to HIV prevention. Be prepared for the unexpected, and that I borrow from my colleague, Susan Backbinder. Communications, communications, and communications. We really need to build trust, but we need to build trust through transparency, to sending the message through telling the community that what we are doing might not work sometimes, or probably most of the time. Protocols do not always have expected results. Tell me about it. We had to face three challenging studies already. Keep the community trust. How do you keep community trust? First of all, by transparency, but also by providing complementary services when we are implementing HIV prevention research. We need to provide healthcare. We need to provide social support. We need to provide personal, psychological support when necessary for participants. So to answer the question, where do we go from here, I could ask the scientists, all the scientists sitting here, that please faithfully continue in the search. Communities are observing and are expecting something from you. And they still want to do something about it. Do not fail on them. Find an alternative to HIV prevention. And involve them in the process because they are already part of the solution. It takes a lot of time to gain community trust, and it takes so little to spoil it. I just want to finish by sharing with you another quote from formative research process we are doing to assess the implementation of a new HIV prevention strategy study. Most of the gay population is willing to participate. We are the population that continues the most on finding a solution to HIV. This is a focus group with gay people between 18 to 30 years old in Lima. As part of this process, we interview the AIDS control officer at the Minister of Health of Ecuador. And she said, talking about HIV prevention research, build research with them, with the gay, trans, and bisexual organizations, and involve the state. We are always open to work together. This is the AIDS control program officer of the Ministry of Health of Ecuador. Thank you.
Well, thank you all on the panel. Thank you all in the audience. As I say, the questions have been just outstanding. We are never going to get to all of them. Let me just say straight up front that at AVAC, we keep an advocates network. And if you go to avac.org, you can sign up for it. And we will undertake, if the panel indulges me, to answer all of the questions that have come in and make that available through the advocates network. So please don't worry. If you ask a question, we will get an answer and we will hopefully get it to you. The first one I wanted to start with doesn't really have an answer, but it really highlights something Manju said. It was a question from someone in Kenya. When will we get to the point in conferences like these where you include trial participants on panels like these to hear firsthand from them so they're not viewed simply as research objects? I don't have a great answer other than to say we screwed up, and it's an important, critical perspective because without trial participants, all the great science in the world won't deliver a vaccine or a microbicide or anything else. But it's a point very well taken for AIDS 2010. So with AIDS 2010 in mind, and I'm welcome to any or all of the panelists to answer, since success, as you look out, undoubtedly over the next 2 years, won't be in a safe and efficacious licensed vaccine or microbicide, flash forward to 2010 in Vienna, or 2012 perhaps with an AIDS conference in the United States, what would success look like from any or all of your perspectives in the sense of vaccine and microbicide development? Seth, do you want to start?
Thank you, Mitchell. I think that's a really important point. And one of the things we tried to do in this year's blueprint is set up a series of interim milestones across all of the different scientific challenges. And I think that's really important because, as somebody said early on in the talk, you know, we don't want to only be shooting for success because that's the ultimate goal, but if we can break them down. So, for example, if we were to find a neutralizing antibody that neutralized an antigen that produced neutralizing antibody to 50% of the moderately resistant strains, that wouldn't be a vaccine yet, but it would be a pretty important milestone. And so we've tried to lay those out for debate and discussion.
Great. Zita, do you want to?
Sure. I think success would be a positive outcome of the CAPRISA study by 2012 that showed that tenofovir gel protected women against HIV infection. It would include the fact that many of the other drugs in the pipeline have moved into efficacy studies or at least further along in safety studies, and that pharmaceutical companies had looked at their portfolios and come up with some great late-stage candidates that can feed the pipeline.
Great. Let me ask it an additional way to you, Tachi. In a previous life at an industry, presumably their bottom lines, their boards of directors, to respond to with success milestones throughout. You have a different structure at the Gates Foundation. What does the foundation, what does the chair people of the foundation, what do they regard as success over the next 2 years?
It's hard. Can you hear me okay?
Oh, is that not working?
Yeah. Just keep talking and they turn it off.
Okay, sorry. I'm not sure exactly what you're asking, whether you're saying do the founders of the foundation expect a certain result from their investments in the next 2 years? I don't really think so. I mean, I think the investment that's made is a long-term investment. This is not about what's going to happen today or tomorrow or the day after tomorrow, but what's going to happen in our lifetimes. And I think that's the way we have to look at it. If we're looking for quick wins, we're only going to have potentially lots of disappointments, because the things that happen quickly, as I said, are milestones on a long journey to hopefully a future without HIV. So I think the Gates Foundation's point of view, and those of the founders, is that we're making this investment not to obtain short-term results, but for long-term wins.
You know, one of the things that will happen in 2009, 2010, potentially are initial results from the current pre-exposure prophylaxis trials. And Susan, both you and Pedro are involved in PrEP studies. Jump ahead. What scenario might you envision for future vaccine and microbicide trials should a PrEP result in 2009, 2010, 2011 show success?
Well, I think that the entire prevention field will welcome and rejoice with success with any of these prevention modalities. And again, I can't emphasize enough that we are a combined prevention field. It's also true that it will be challenging to test new prevention strategies when we have successful strategies to see what the incremental benefit is. That said, I think that there are clearly ways of doing that, and that there are in the same way that vaccines and microbicides are looking for incremental gains, I think we need to prepare for incremental gains in the pre-exposure prophylaxis field. We're clearly, none of these strategies is likely to give us a complete protection in all study volunteers, and it's going to raise a host of questions about do we see some level of protection, in whom do we see protection, and how do we build upon that. So I do see that the field is going to get increasingly complex as we look at combinations of approaches, biomedical and behavioral, but I think we'll all be richer for it, and we'll hope for those successes, even though it will mean increasingly complex trials.
Great complexities we look for. Pedro, do you want to add anything?
What I think it could be a success in the PrEP arena is that we find efficacious and safe medication that will sell with help for PrEP and at accessible price to all the people who need it so they can have a better life.
Great. You know, A couple of questions came in, and I think both for Zita and Manju. You both alluded and talked very briefly about rectal components, but the focus was clearly on vaginal microbicides. But a number of questions about what about rectal microbicides and where do they fit in, and I wonder both if both of you would like to comment on that.
Sure, I can start. I think rectal microbicides are incredibly important and need to be developed. I think that the field has started with vaginal microbicides because we believe that the proof of concept for efficacy for a vaginal microbicide will be, although challenging, a little simpler. It's a more defined space. All of the development has been done in the context of the vaginal environment. Rectal microbicides need to be developed. They are going to be very different products. They may have the same active agents, but they will need to be formulated differently, and that work needs to be encouraged.
Manju?
There's not much I can add to that except that it really is important, and really want to give kudos to groups like IRMA for really raising the profile of this important issue. They really moved the field forward in considering this now as opposed to only after we have a vaginal microbicide.
Great, thanks. You know, throughout the fields of prevention research, the last period has not been the easiest, and there are a number of questions. Here's someone, stupidity is doing the same thing again and again. Expecting a different result, when are you going to give up? Is there a point at which we, as a scientific community, must move on to a different field? Alan, you're now running the global HIV vaccine enterprise at a time of a lot of voices, or a few voices saying, oh, let's give up. This is a waste. And yet you talk about young investigators and the need to bring them in. How do we do that? What's the answer to this? Are we doing the same thing over and over?
Well, I think that's an excellent question, Mitchell. I think as we discussed yesterday at the satellite, I think we have to convey a message to young people and people from the developing world and from adjacent scientific areas that first and foremost, this has got to be the biggest humanitarian challenge facing the planet today. And so the rewards for all of us who participate in developing a vaccine will be enormous in terms of the satisfaction we can take from contributing to solving this pandemic. Secondly, the scientific challenges, which is after all what motivates a scientist, are huge. At the end of the day, I think that's what young people find the most interesting. The third, and this is something that came out again yesterday, is there has been a lot of new money going into HIV vaccine research over the last few years, thanks to the generosity of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the new money that's come from NIH, the Canadian Initiative, and other initiatives around the world. So I think there is, a scientist needs money to do work. So I think there's money on the table. And then a fourth point that came up was, I think, a growing recognition by the senior and I think quite distinguished scientists in the field of the importance of attracting young people to this area. So if I were a young person now, and some days I wish I were, if I were a young person starting out, I think those four components, the humanitarian challenge, the scientific challenge, the availability of resources, and the support of senior colleagues, is exactly what you all the ingredients one needs, I think, to do it. So we have to get those messages out now to those communities.
Great. Seth, did you want to add something?
Just a word. If we were back in 1984, 1985, 1986 and talking about creating drugs for viral infections, scientists, a lot of them, said we don't know how to do this. And the issue is you got to trust science at the end of the day. We have fabulous tools with us. We now have more antiretroviral drugs for HIV than all other viruses put together. That's the power of science, and we just need to make sure that we continue to focus this on these very difficult problems.
You know, Tachi, you had mentioned the issue of going from small trials, and we will get into, in the future, larger trials. They're expensive. Is there a way that we can or should be optimizing clinical trials now, either in our early phases or planning forward to efficacy trials?
Yes, I think there are many things that we can do. This is one of the key points that I was trying to make, that we have lots of ideas. We don't have the money to test all those ideas to the fullest extent possible. So we have to hedge our bets. We have to have indicators that an approach to a vaccine or a microbicide will work, and those indicators must be tested and must be robust. The way we do it is, in a way, through trials like STEP. The STEP trial, which was a trial that didn't show a positive endpoint, showed a lot of information which will help us to predict what will be successful the next time around. And I think that this is the critical element of the trials that don't come out in the most positive light. They actually are milestones on the way to success.
Great, thanks. You know, we have very little time left, and I thought what we might do, and I'm going to try to do it quickly, is if I could ask each of you, well, maybe we'll start with Pedro in reverse order. In 30 seconds or less, this will be a lightning round, what keeps you up at night? And I'm not trying to get personal here, but when you look at vaccines and microbicides going forward, from where you sit, what keeps you up at night?
Well, I think that a vaccine is necessary. Fortunately, we are still far from it, and we need something in the meantime to help people live better, free of HIV.
Great. Thanks. Zita.
That we're not moving smartly enough and fast enough to be able to get the products out there as quickly as possible.
Great. Great answer, and fast.
You're going to get us all saying similar things, because really it is about how long will this take and what is the activities we can each do to move this forward quickly and effectively, but in a way that makes the best use of the resources, limited resources that we have at hand.
Similarly, I worry about short-termism, and I worry not only about not interested in these longer-term preventive strategies, which is critical, but also, you know, is HIV going to remain on the agenda? There's a lot of other global challenges, and so how do we make sure HIV remains on the agenda? And then resources, and particularly flexible resources that allow you to be quick and in your movement and be able to push ideas forward.
I think we're moving into increasingly complex times. The lessons learned from each of these trials are exceedingly difficult to communicate and to fully mine. And so I think trying to move forward together as both a scientific and a community of people who are deeply affected by HIV is to try to keep everybody up to speed in increasingly complex environment.
Two things keep me up at night. One is New York traffic. And the second is the tension, I think, between the obvious urgency of developing a vaccine and the point that Tachi's been making, which is this is going to be a long journey, and how do we ensure that we're all in it for the long haul?
Thanks.
I suppose there are two things that can keep you up at night. One is fear of a problem, and the other is excitement about the prospect. And from my point of view, I think there's a lot of excitement that major advances can be made to prevent HIV transmission. I think that's as much something that will keep me awake as fear of failure.
That's great. Well, thank you all very much. A couple of quick notes. There are a number of sessions that will expand on what you heard here. There is a prevention research roadmap. You can get it in the Global Village at booth number 263 or at a booth on prevention advocacy in the exhibition hall 408 to find a roadmap for where you can see many of these very same people and many others talking about these issues. As I said before, we will undertake to answer all of these questions on the AVAC Advocates Network at the AVAC.org website, or send emails to avac@avac.org. And finally, I think just picking up on all of these last comments, I'm always reminded of Winston Churchill's comment about what is success. Success is moving from failure to failure with no less enthusiasm. And if that doesn't describe the way forward in prevention research and the way forward in responding to this epidemic, I don't know what does. So I thank you all for spending the last couple of hours with this distinguished panel, and onwards in the search. Thank you.